With stays under $250 a night, Vrbo makes it easy to celebrate sweater weather. Book a cabin with leaf views or a home with a fire pit for nights with friends. With stays under $250 a night, find a home for your exact needs. Book now at Vrbo.com.
Okay, let's dive into something truly impactful today. We're exploring Rich Dad, Poor Dad, right? A book by Robert Kiyosaki and Sharon Lecter that has, really shifted financial perspectives for millions globally.
It really has. First published back in 97, it's just become this phenomenon.
42 million copies, over 50 languages.
Yeah, and 6 years on the New York Times bestseller list. Even Oprah gave it a nod. It's huge.
And the core of it, it really unpacks the author's own experience, doesn't it? Having these two father figures.
Exactly. And the biological dad, the poor dad, highly educated, worked hard, but, financially didn't get far.
Right. Comfortable, but not wealthy.
And then his friend Mike's dad, the rich dad. Fewer degrees, apparently, but made significantly more money.
And that setup, it just creates this powerful comparison of two really, really different ways of thinking about money.
Oh, absolutely striking. And how those mindsets just clash. Think about these opposing ideas.
Like what?
Well, like the love of money is the root of all evil versus, the rich dad saying the lack of money is the root of all evil.
Wow, that's a contrast.
Or just saying, I can't afford it versus always asking, okay, how can I afford it?
Changes everything, that question.
Doesn't it? And maybe the most telling one. Study hard so you can find a good company to work for versus study hard so you can find a good company to buy.
Totally different goals.
Completely. So our mission today, really, is to distill those six key rules from the summary. The ones the authors think will help your money start working for you instead of, the other way around.
Okay, rule one. This one kicks off with a pretty vivid story from the author's childhood. He was 9.
Yeah, 9 years old, told to make money, and he and his friend Mike literally tried melting down old toothpaste tubes.
To make nickels, I love that.
It's quite something. But that's when Mike's dad, the rich dad, steps in, promises to teach them, but crucially not in a classroom.
Right, real world lessons.
And what he taught them was just profound. It's this fundamental shift. The poor work for money, but the rich, they have money work for them.
That sounds simple, but it's huge.
It is. Because most of us, the book argues, get caught in this trap. The rat race, they call it.
Explain that a bit more, the trap.
Well, it's a cycle, right? Working for that monthly salary, always looking forward to the next pay hike, paying bills.
Holding on to that idea of job security.
Exactly, that illusion of security.
Yeah.
And just waiting for retirement. It's relentless.
Sounds exhausting, that rat race. So what does the book say really keeps people stuck in it? What's fueling it?
It boils down to two really powerful emotions, fear and greed.
Fear and greed, how so?
Well, the fear of losing your job, of not being able to pay the bills, that drags you into the race.
Okay.
And then the greed, the desire to buy more stuff, have nicer things, that keeps you running faster and faster within the race.
So money ends up controlling your emotions.
Precisely. Fear allows money, or the lack of it, to dictate how you feel and react. And it really forces you to ask, is a job the best long-term path to wealth?
Yeah.
A book strongly suggests it's often just a short-term fix for a long-term problem.
That's a powerful way to put it. So the book offers an antidote, right, to get out of this fear-greed cycle. It's not about changing jobs necessarily, but something internal.
Exactly. It's about consciously choosing your thoughts instead of just reacting emotionally.
Yeah.
Like, I worked hard. I deserve this raise.
Which is a common thought.
Very common.
Yeah.
But instead, you pause. You ask yourself, okay, wait, is there something I'm missing here? Is there a better way? It's shifting from being reactive to being, proactive about your thinking.
And that small mental shift, it actually led to a real-world venture for the author and Mike pretty early on.
It did. That lesson pushed them to start a little comic book lending library.
Right.
Now, it only lasted 3 months, apparently.
Yeah.
But the key thing was the principle they learned. Their money was working for them. It was generating income, even when they weren't physically there shelving comics. They started to get that taste of being masters of their finances, not just, employees.
So fast forward a few decades. The author actually retires at 47.
Pretty young, yeah. His money was genuinely working for him by then.
And Mike.
Mike had taken over his dad's business and apparently grew it exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them credit rich dad's lessons, especially this idea of financial literacy.
Okay, rule two then. Financial literacy is necessary.
Absolutely crucial. And the core lesson here, according to Rich Dad, is actually quite simple, but so often misunderstood.
Okay.
You must understand the difference between an asset and a liability.
Sounds fundamental. So what is the difference, according to Rich Dad?
It's straightforward. Assets put money in your pocket. Liabilities take money out of your pocket.
In your pocket, out of your pocket. Okay.
The fascinating or maybe concerning part is how many of us think liabilities are assets? Which, you know, makes you ask yourself, is your house an asset or a liability?
Whoa, okay. That's a big one. Most people think of their house as their biggest asset.
Exactly. And the book tackles that head on.
So how does it justify calling a house bought on a mortgage a liability? I mean, there's equity, tax breaks.
Right. It acknowledges the emotional side, the tax benefits.
Mm.
But purely from an accounting cash flow perspective, if you've got a 20 or 30 year mortgage,
which most people do,
then that house is taking money out of your pocket every single month. Mortgage payments, interest, property taxes, insurance, upkeep. It's a constant outflow.
So until it's paid off, it's technically draining cash.
In that sense, yes, it's a liability. And the authors argue that focusing on your mortgaged house as your primary asset can actually hold back your financial education. It ties up cash that could be building real income-generating assets.
Hmm. Okay, so what's the alternative?
Well, the mantra they push is this. The rich buy assets. The poor have expenses. And the middle class buys liabilities, thinking they are assets. The key is to focus first on building up that asset column, things that generate income. Then use that income to afford the luxuries, like a nice house, mm-hmm. without it crippling your cash flow.
So if you get a raise,
ideally, you invest that extra money into more income-generating assets, not just, you know, a bigger car payment or a bigger mortgage.
Got it. Okay, rule three, mind your own business. This starts with McDonald's.
Yeah, it's a great example. You ask anyone what McDonald's business is, they'll say burgers, right? Fast food.
Of course.
But Rich Dad, Mike's dad, used Ray Kroc, the founder, as an example. Kroc himself apparently believed McDonald's wasn't primarily in the burger business.
Oh, what was it then?
Real estate. They sell the franchise, sure, but they own the extremely valuable land underneath all those golden arches. That was the real business engine.
Huh. Never thought of it that way. So what does that McDonald's story teach us about our own finances? What's the connection?
It highlights this really critical difference between your profession and your business.
Profession versus business. Explain that.
Okay, so as professionals, doctors, lawyers, employees, we spend our time minding someone else's business, usually for a salary. That's your profession. It earns your income.
Right.
Your business, on the other hand, is what you do with that income. It's about taking that earned money and buying or building assets that generate more income. It's building up your own asset column separate from your job.
Minding your own business is bottom line, essentially.
Exactly. Your profession pays the bills initially, but your business should be building your wealth.
And this connects back to the asset liability thing, because things we think are assets, like our mortgaged house or the car we bought on a loan,
can quickly become heavy liabilities if you lose your job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Suddenly they're just draining cash.
Precisely. Because they require that steady income from your profession to service the debt. If that income stops, they become millstones.
So minding your own businesses really means?
It means actively acquiring true assets, things that generate revenue independently, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, maybe income-producing real estate where the rent more than covers the mortgage and expenses. It's about building those streams of income, not just stuff that costs you money.
Okay, makes sense. Rule four, use the cover of a corporation. This sounds a bit complex. It touches on taxes.
It does. The summary mentions, you know, the history of taxes becoming permanent in the U.S. with the 16th Amendment and how they seem to have, well, widened the gap between the haves and have-nots.
How so?
Well, what's fascinating, or maybe frustrating, depending on your view, is the different way the haves often interact with the tax system compared to employees, the have-nots.
What's the difference?
For most people with jobs, tax is taken out before they even see their paycheck, right? Paycheck arrives, tax is gone.
Yep, P-Y-E, withholding.
Exactly. The irony the book points out is that sometimes the very people who believe in a kind of Robin Hood idea, tax the rich, more end up being the ones most efficiently taxed by the current system.
Hmm. So how do corporations or the haves using them play a different game? This is where financial IQ comes in.
Exactly. Building financial IQ is presented as crucial for managing taxes effectively. It involves four key things, according to the summary.
Okay, what are they?
First, understanding accounting. Basic stuff, especially if you want to mind your own business so you can actually read financial statements and know what's going on.
Makes sense.
Second,
understanding investing the science, or maybe art, of making money grow.
Right. Third.
Third, understanding markets, supply and demand, how they work, what influences them.
Okay. And fourth.
And fourth, understanding the law, particularly tax law, and how it treats income differently for an individual versus a corporation.
Ah, so that's the key, the legal structure.
It's a major part of it,
yeah.
Because it connects to this bigger picture distinction. When you work for someone, the flow is earn here, pay taxes, spend what's left.
Standard employee experience. Right. But when you effectively mind your own business through a corporate structure, the potential flow becomes earn spend on legitimate business expenses, pay taxes on what's left.
So you spend before taxes are calculated on the remainder.
Potentially, yes.
Yeah.
And that difference, that timing and ability to deduct expenses first, can offer significant tax advantages. It's a core strategy.
Interesting. Okay, rule five, the rich invent money. That sounds intriguing. How does the book explain that? It uses Alexander Graham Bell.
Yeah, great story. Bell patents the telephone, right? Mm-hmm. Offers the whole thing patent, company to Western Union, for $100,000.
And they said no, famously.
Turned him down flat. Yeah. So Bell goes off and ends up creating AT&T, a billion-dollar industry.
Wow. So what's the lesson there about inventing money?
Well, part of it is about that internal voice, isn't it? That inner critic the book mentions. Bell must have had doubts, seeking validation from the big guys at Western Union.
Sure, natural reaction.
But there's also that brave hero inside, the book says. The part willing to push forward, to build something amazing, even after rejection, like Bell did. It's about overcoming that self-doubt.
So it's psychological as much as financial.
Very much so. But it connects to this broader idea about what wealth even is today.
How so? What does the Bell story tell us about wealth now?
Well, think about it. A few hundred years ago, wealth was land, right?
Yeah.
Tangible stuff.
Yeah, owning property.
Today, the book argues wealth is really about information. And information isn't tied down by geography. It moves instantly.
Okay.
So the core concept here, the real financial intelligence, is understanding that money itself, it isn't really real. It's more like an illusion, an idea.
Money is an idea.
That's the provocative claim. The real asset, the real money-making machine, is your mind.
How does that work? A mind creating money.
A well-trained mind, one with that financial IQ we talked about, starts to see opportunities that others miss. Opportunities that can eventually be turned into money, into assets.
So it's about perception and creativity.
Exactly. And when you truly grasp that money starts as an idea in your mind, you become perhaps more willing to take calculated risks. To invest in opportunities that look like nothing to the untrained eye, you're inventing value, inventing money, in a sense.
Okay, I think I get that. Rule six then, work to learn, don't work for money. There's a quote here about being one skill away from great wealth.
Yeah, a business consultant told the author that. You are one skill away from great wealth.
What's the deep meaning there for us?
It suggests that sometimes just mastering one additional key skill can cause your income, your potential, to jump exponentially. It's not always about working harder at the same thing.
So it links back to that financial IQ idea again.
Definitely. While working hard is, you know, drummed into us, the book argues it's about combining hard work with smart work, with that financial intelligence. It's not just effort, it's directed, knowledgeable effort.
And there's that contrast again between the dads, poor dad saying specialize, rich dad saying know a little about a lot. Why is breadth better for wealth, according to this view?
Well, the argument is that hyper-specialization, while valuable for a profession, can limit you if you stay in the same narrow lane for years. You might become excellent at one thing, but miss the bigger picture.
And get too comfortable with job security.
Exactly. The book sees falling in love with job security as a potential long-term trap, because true security comes from adaptability and broad knowledge. Education, especially financial and business education, is framed as ultimately more valuable than money itself, because it equips you to create money.
So what kind of broad skills are we talking about?
The book highlights key management skills. Managing cash flow, critical. Managing systems or time, and managing people.
The basics of running anything, really.
Pretty much. And then, hugely important, are communication skills, and especially the ability to sell. Selling ideas, selling yourself, selling products, these are seen as core skills for success in almost any area of life, particularly business.
Okay, so we've covered the six rules. But the book acknowledges, right, that even people who understand this stuff, who are financially literate, can still struggle.
Yes, absolutely. It addresses that directly. Why do people who know better still not do better?
So what are some of the big reasons it gives?
Well, the first one is huge and universal. Fear. Specifically, the fear of losing money.
Makes sense. Nobody wants to lose money.
Right. But the way you respond to that fear is key. Playing it too safe, avoiding any risk, can actually lead to a bigger problem down the line. It becomes a fear of failure itself, which can paralyze you.
Okay, fear of loss. What else?
But then there's deep-rooted cynicism. You know, that inner critic again.
The what if it all goes wrong voice.
Exactly. Constantly creating doomsday scenarios in your head.
Yeah.
Just strangles opportunities before they even get considered. You talk yourself out of buying good assets because you're focused only on the potential downside.
Yeah, I can see that. What's next?
Laziness. And the book clarifies it's often not about being idle, but more about being too busy to deal with your finances or avoiding unpleasant truths about your financial health.
Using busyness as an excuse.
Sort of. And the book offers a slightly controversial antidote. Cultivate a little bit of greed, not destructive greed, but the kind that makes you ask, what's in this for me? How can I get more out of this situation to overcome that inertia?
Interesting take. What about habits?
Bad habits, definitely.
Okay.
A key one mentioned is prioritizing paying everyone else before paying yourself. You know, bills come in, you pay them immediately. Creditors first.
Isn't that responsible?
It sounds responsible, but Rich Dad's philosophy is pay yourself first. Allocate money to your investments, your asset column, first. Then figure out how to pay the bills. The pressure, supposedly, forces you to find ways to generate more income rather than just letting your assets starve. Don't let bill collectors push you around, basically. Manage your cash flow.
Right. And the last pitfall.
Arrogance, which the book calls a lethal combination of ego and ignorance. Yeah. Thinking you know it all when you actually don't, and therefore not listening or learning the solution. Simple, but not easy. Educate yourself. Humble yourself enough to learn instead of falling for, you know, snake oil sales pitches or pretending you have all the answers.
So understanding the rules is one thing. Overcoming these internal barriers is another.
Crucial difference.
Okay, so pulling it all together, this deep dive isn't just theoretical. There's a clear call to action here, isn't there?
Absolutely. It's not just about understanding. It's about doing. The summary really urges you. Take action. Start looking for new ideas. Find teachers. Find mentors. Learn from others.
It even recommends specific resources.
Yeah, it specifically mentions Peter Lynch's book, Beating the Street for Understanding Stock Picking. And it gives that classic contrarian advice. When the stock market crashes, don't panic and run. Instead, that's your signal to dive into the deep end and start buying.
Buy when there's blood in the streets, as they say.
That kind of thinking. Because remember, money is just an idea, an illusion. The real skill, the science of making money, is about thinking differently, seeing those opportunities, building those assets.
It's why that other famous book is called Think and Grow Rich.
Exactly. Not work hard and grow rich. Mm-hmm. Thinking comes first. Building that strong financial IQ helps you move past generic advice and actually leverage real insights to change your financial future.
This whole deep dive, it really forces a reevaluation, doesn't it? Those foundational beliefs about work, money, assets. It's not just about earning more.
Not at all. It's about what your money does for you, how you structure things, how you think.
So if we connect all this back, the biggest investment isn't necessarily stocks or real estate.
It's in yourself, in your financial education, in developing that mindset, because action always, always beats inaction.
Which leaves us, and you listening, with a really important question to mull over, doesn't it?
It does. What specific action, maybe even just a small one, can you take today, right now, to start training your mind to see those opportunities and begin that shift towards having your money work for you?